You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme.
I expect and hope and believe that Europe can show the flexibility that when one of the larger countries, a big contributor, a major European player, has some problems and issues, that those issues can be properly addressed.
Tough talk from a man on a mission. David Cameron has been in Germany to convince its leader of the case for EU reform. But has he won her round? My guests Kathleen Burke and Jeffrey Kaufman will be in the studio to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including, despite the scandal plaguing the game, will FIFA boss Sepp Blatter score another term in office? They are counting the votes right now. We'll ask who is on his team and why, and we'll discuss America's role in investigating the beleaguered body. All that, plus a look at those still hoping to run for the US presidency. Plus, we mark the International Day of UN Peacekeepers. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and the journalist Jeffrey Kaufman. Welcome both back to the programme. We'll start with British Prime Minister David Cameron, who's been continuing his tour of Europe. He's attempting to negotiate a difficult balance, essentially pleading with the EU to reform the UK's relationship with it so he doesn't have to threaten the EU with the UK's exit. Cameron has promised the British people a referendum. He hopes to be able to present a case for continuing membership, whatever the wilder reaches of his own party might think. Kathleen, Angela Merkel has said today that Germany will be, and I quote, a constructive partner. I do always enjoy translating diplo-speak into plain English. Or euphemism, I guess you could call it euphemism.
You want to know what it means,
yes.
Do you?
What does constructive partner mean in this instance?
It means on the whole she'll help, but it's going to be a hell of a way on the way, more or less. I mean, constructive means that she doesn't agree with everything he wants, but on the whole, she thinks something can be made out of it. As diplo-speak goes, that's pretty straightforward, actually.
It doesn't sound as serious as a full and frank discussion, does it?
No, that's getting down to blows, in fact. Verbal or sometimes even better. No, I think it's the best he can expect. It fundamentally says, yes, I support you, but you're going to have to give quite a lot before you get my full support.
What we're starting to notice, I think, in the last couple of days is what the rest of the EU regards as the uncrossable red lines. And it strikes me, I'll put this to you, Jeffrey, that here is where David Cameron finds himself in a bind, because Angela Merkel suggested that one of these red lines is the principle of freedom of movement. But it strikes me, at least, that this referendum that the UK is going to have is essentially a referendum on exactly that. I think when you boil it down, this is about immigration as far as the British public is concerned.
Well, first of all, I think I disagree with Kathleen. I think actually this is a significant shift. It's a subtle shift in diplo speak, but I think it actually represents a really significant shift on Angela Merkel's part. And it's a recognition that David Cameron won a majority, you know, outright. And you can't, you know, the guy has the mandate. And let's
you think
face
that makes him a more serious figure as far as the rest of the EU is concerned.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, he's fresh off a mandate. He unexpectedly won a majority, and the UK is a major player in the EU. I mean, nobody wants to see this is not Liechtenstein. You know, this and so you know what you're seeing is that the stridency and the inflexibility of Poland, France, Germany that we saw months ago is softening because they face a reality. You know, they see that, you know, I'm sure there've got to be people at Downing Street who say, why did Cameron ever pledge this in-out referendum in 17? He was so afraid of Nigel Farage, who is now, you know, absolutely obliterated in this election. You know, he was chasing ghosts hindsight.
Cameron may have assumed that he would be leading another coalition and therefore could dump this referendum and blame it on his coalition partners.
I think all of the above, but I also think he assumed that Nigel Farage would do much better than he did. He didn't even win his own seat. And so, you know, Europe is facing a reality. And You know, you can look at this in two ways. One is, you know, hey, the EU is a deal, and it shouldn't be changed. The other is that the world changes, and you know, things happen in unexpected ways, and you know, there is an issue with immigration here, whether some of it is race baiting or intolerance, but some of it is some of it can be seen as legitimate issues of the system being gamed. But I don't think it's just that. You know, Cameron's worried about the city and the integrity of the financial markets that sustain so much of the UK economy. He doesn't want the EU legislating away a lot of the kind of the coziness and the deal making that have made London such a prosperous place.
Well, I disagree slightly with Jeffrey's disagreeing with me in a sense. Infinite regress here. The point is that she has always said she supports Britain staying in. Now, I take your point that the constructive bit is a slight change in words, but I don't think there's much of a change in intention. She has said, that does say, that it is slightly more helpful, I think. But immigration has always been a problem. But what that implies, she said today, did she not, that perhaps we can do something about the benefits, which is the crucial thing over here. So, and I take your point as well that he got through. But, you know, there's a lot of countries. Poland has got a very strong red line, for example. And you've got 28 red lines. This is a kaleidoscope.
Well, it is true. It's very hard. I mean, you look at the UN. You would never build the UN the way it was built today. But, you know, try rebuilding it. We did that once in 1948. You know, these international organizations become kind of these monsters, these monoliths, and it's very hard to refashion them. But there is a real realpolitik here that Cameron is pointing out. And I think that it's true, Poland, you know, it's going to be hard to get consensus, but the momentum is now in his favor, and Merkel is suggesting that she's on side. When you get Germany lining up with the UK, it does put some muscle behind an open-mindedness towards reform.
But poor France. Poor France. Yeah. And the other thing is, of course, Cameron was quite right when he says that this is all public setting out of where you're going to start is putting out your negotiating position. The only difficulty with that, of course, is in some countries it might be difficult to back down domestically. But they're all putting out their major positions, and then that's what negotiating is about.
But Cameron surely needs to be able to come back with something about immigration, whether it's some sort of opt-out for Britain on freedom of movement, which the Germans have already ruled out, or whether it's the sort of restriction you were suggesting on benefits to migrants, which the Poles have said is a red line. I think he...
Is that the opinion polls or the Polish people?
The Polish people. I'm pretty sure it's a red line in terms of opinion polls in this country.
The president has already said it as well as the prime minister.
I mean, it strikes me, I have to say, as somebody, the first visa I arrived here on was conditional on that. I was not allowed to claim benefits for 4 or 5 years or whatever it was as a self-employed Commonwealth citizen, which struck me at the time as about fair enough. But can David Cameron actually win an EU referendum in this country if he's got nothing out of the EU in terms of immigration?
I think it's just too early. I think we've got 2 years to answer that question. I think that there are too many variables at play. But I think that if I were David Cameron, I would feel pretty good about, you know, not only did he get a peck on the cheek from Angela Merkel today that appeared in all the papers, and he got a very nice meal I think that included shrimp and veal scallops and strawberries. He can come back and say, look, you know, there's some movement. Of course, he doesn't really have to worry about accountability. He just won a majority, so you know, his worry is really setting the stage for that 17 referendum.
Final thought on this, Kathleen. Jeffrey's invocation of the fact that we might be in for at least 2 years of this has just caused my own heart to perceptibly sink at that realization. Is there an argument for Cameron, and this has been floated, of just trying to yank this forward and get it over with?
Well, Philip Hammond, the foreign secretary, seems to be implying that things will be sorted out by the end of the summer and just into early next year, he said. And you can interpret that if you wish. I mean, what's going to happen is they're going to look at the polls, aren't they? They're going to see if it does have momentum. And
you don't call a referendum if you think you can't win it.
Funny that. Mm. Yes, and because it does now say, do you agree to remain in, you have to really be against it. And this is a on the whole, a conservative country. They're already in. And remember, one must remember the last referendum in 1975. It looked like it was going to be horribly competitive. And what was it? 2-1 in favor of remaining in.
Okay, well, in between lobbying his fellow EU leaders, David Cameron has also added his voice to a large global chorus suggesting that, all things considered, it might be time that FIFA thanked Sepp Blatter for his service. Undeterred, indeed apparently undeterrable, Blatter stood today for a fifth term as FIFA president, even as several of his senior officials assist with various inquiries. He did not carry the first round of voting, is the latest in the last few minutes. He needed 140 votes, or a two-thirds majority. He got 133, so this will go to a second round in which I think I'm right in saying he just needs a majority. It does seem likely, at the risk of perpetrating a Dewey defeats Truman moment, that Sepp Blatter will be re-elected as FIFA president for a fifth term. Jeffrey, I'll ask you first, is it a fun speculative question at this point, is it possible to even imagine the embarrassment that would cause Sepp Blatter to resign?
I think we're seeing a critical mass. If I were looking in my crystal ball, I think that I'm not sure I see him walking away in handcuffs. But I think that what's interesting now, this is a business, and this is a business that relies on big advertisers. And you know, as much as football, soccer, whatever you call it, you know, is worth billions of dollars to all of these companies. It is also, there's a tipping point with all of these big corporations now. And do they want to be associated with Al Capone? Do they want to, you know, a guy who will not take ownership? I mean, for him to have the moxie to say, you know, this, it's not my doing and I'm going to clean it up. He's been running the joint for 15
years.
It's
almost impressive.
It is impressive. I mean, it's so impressive that you want him to, you know, the world would celebrate if they indicted him, which they have not done, to be clear. But nobody would be surprised. And you know, this is just, I think that's what you want to watch. That you want to watch the advertisers, the marketing people who are behind this. And I think some of the big Western countries, you know, Cameron taking a stand, you know, that, in a funny way, that's a fairly brave thing to do. You know, the international FIFA is a powerful body, and you know, and you look at the love of football here. For him to challenge that, and you know, this talk of boycotting the World Cup. I mean, that's
a lot of talk, especially about 2022 in Qatar. I think most people see the award of the World Cup to Russia in 2018 as, I mean, that's a makeable case. Russia is a country with a long and proud footballing history. I think Qatar, I think that has been the one on which has stuck in a lot of people's craw for all sorts of reasons. And on which subject, Jeffrey, talking there, Kathleen, about the money involved and the sponsors and the advertisers who probably will end up having the critical say eventually. But why has it, from their point of view, why is it the stories of corruption within FIFA that have upset them and caused them to wobble, none of which I don't think is exactly a revelation to anybody who's been paying attention for the last few decades, why is it not the deaths of at least 2,000 migrant workers so far that we know of in Qatar?
Well, first of all, it's the American FBI who went for these malfeasance, and that has made decent headlines in the United States. These are all, pretty well all American companies who are very aware of their public persona and really don't like to be behind, whether it's football coaches who rape widely or whatever. And no one pays any attention to Qatar. I will take, say, an appalling thing here. If 5% of Americans can point to Qatar on a map, I will be astonished. But they all know what football is. And of course, soccer in America has become much more widely played and widely watched in the past 10 years than it had before. It's all coming together. If it had not been the FBI who had led on this, I wouldn't think it would have made quite such an impact.
On that subject, Jeffrey, and this has perplexed quite a lot of people. This is America, at least North America, the United States, is possibly the major world power which is least interested in what they call soccer. Why has it been them that are leading the way on this
one? You know, just to correct you on that, the U.S. did bid for the World Cup in 22.
They hosted it in 94.
Right, but they bid for it again in 22 and got outmaneuvered by Qatar. And so, you know, there is growing interest in it, and certainly an effort to make it a business and to make it a sport in the U.S. Listen, this is the way the U.S. operates in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, people love to criticize the U.S., but the U.S. isn't shy about using its legal and moral authority. You know, Swiss banking is another example. Why does it all come back to Switzerland? But, you know, funny thing. I wonder if there'll be indictments in the chocolate industry. But, you know, the U.S. is one of the few countries that has the power and the resources to do this, and the law, and the legal framework to do this, because they're doing it through bank accounts, through U.S.-based companies. This really stinks. I just think this is disgusting, what's going on in FIFA. And I think the world, you know, this guy should not be allowed to continue. The reason he got reelected, or is going to get reelected, is because he surrounded himself by corrupt cronies who have been bought off by you know, nepotism and patronage and all sorts of wonderful benefits. I mean, wouldn't we all like to live like princes below the radar? It has to stop, and good for Cameron, you know, and I hope, you know, Cameron says he's not welcome here. You know, it is so deeply offensive. It's only a game, but man, they are playing with billions.
Kathleen, is there? It is hard to know what will happen next. We assume that Blatter, bizarre though it seems, is going to get re-elected. There has been some big talk in the last few days. We've heard Michel Platini, who's the president of UEFA, suggesting that UEFA might not show up for the next World Cup or the one after. Greg Dyke, the chairman of the English FA, has made similar noises. Is that what it will take? Just one major figure or one major footballing body just to say, no, we're out?
Well, I just don't know. I mean, Sepp Blatter blamed it on this whole thing on England and the United States because they didn't get their bids to run the World Cup. If UEFA isn't in, there's an awful lot of other countries. On the other hand, will the entire focus of the world be on, Morocco or... you know, Uruguay or Costa Rica. It may be that the broadcasting organizations don't think it's worth their time and money. So without UEFA, it would be a much poorer cup, I think. And that may, when push comes to shove a bit.
Okay.
I think that what we should watch for is some backroom phone calls, some discreet phone calls between some of the big advertisers behind this, who create a coalition. I think that this is the case. If I were running, you know, who is it who supports them? Well, it ain't going to be Emirates Airlines that does this. Let's be clear. But some of the big companies that market this, Nike or Adidas, whoever it is, I'd be calling the other people with huge contracts and saying, guys, let's have a conference call here. And I think that would, to me, be the way to say it is, we six executives of six of the biggest advertisers will not continue our funding if there are not structural changes and changes in leadership. That's the way this is going to change in my
mind.
Any
bets?
Well, I think I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't survive this next term. I think he's just, the tipping point is past.
Well, we shall move on, and we will close this discussion with the heartwarming latest bulletin from Zurich, which is that Prince Ali bin Al Hussein has announced that he is withdrawing from the race. Sepp Blatter is therefore re-elected as president of FIFA for a fifth term. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, and my guests, Kathleen Burke and Jeffrey Kaufman. Coming up next, who wants to run the USA?
The Big Interview is a new series here on Monocle 24. Hosted by our senior editors, it brings you one-to-one detailed discussions with leading names from the worlds of politics, business, culture, and design. Tune in every Sunday at 9 a.m. London time to hear Monocle's insight into some of the great minds shaping our world today. This week, Monocle's Steve Bloomfield meets leading South African photographer David Goldblatt.
It only became apparent over a number of years that what excited me was something outside of my own insight in the real world that made me want to touch it, and that became touching it with the camera.
That's The Big Interview with David Goldblatt this Sunday right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are Kathleen Burke and Jeffrey Kaufman. Now, former New York Governor George Pataki has announced his candidacy for the Republican nomination for next year's U.S. presidential election, probably figuring that seeing as how everyone else has, he might as well. Many bookmakers aren't even bothering to offer odds on Pataki, meaning that he's actually a longer shot than Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is constitutionally prohibited from holding the office. But it does give us a chance to discuss who might be taking the oath 602 days from now. Kathleen, I'll ask you first. Measured against the 2012 field, and I invite you to remember that both Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee have declared, does this field strike you as more or less bonkers than the last one?
Well, I'm not sure about bonkers. It's considerably more fun. I mean, Pataki...
You say tomato.
Yeah, I mean, give Pataki his due. He has a recognition factor of nearly 1%. Mm-hmm. Now, that's probably more than... Ben Carson did, and so forth. Why not, is the idea. It's very difficult for party that's been in office the previous two terms to get the next term. So the chances are, at least overall, that the Republicans will have a good bit. There's no front runner. There's no incumbent. So everyone theoretically has an even chance. And we all thought that Jeb Bush was going to be so far ahead that no one would even want to contest it. And what's happened? He hasn't even declared. But it means we're all getting to know an awful lot of ex-governors and senators.
Jeffrey, this is possibly wishful thinking on my part.
Getting into the realm of speculation again?
I am.
Next time I come here, I'm bringing a crystal ball and putting it in the middle of this table.
I'm just a massive fan of the great drama of presidential elections. Is there any chance, do you think, that the Republicans might have a complete Barry Goldwater variety moment of madness and nominate Rand Paul or someone?
They haven't in recent years, have they? They've come
quite
close.
Quite disappointing, yeah.
They've flirted with it, and they found in Romney and McCain, they found, you know, fairly centrist conservatives.
Who didn't win, of course.
Right, but because their fear is that if they don't try to embrace a big tent, then they have no chance. Now, the wild card in that whole picture isn't actually Rand Paul, it's Marco Rubio, who is, you know, way too young and way too inexperienced to be president, but has perhaps a reasonable shot. And he's an interesting guy because he's a Florida senator, son of Cuban immigrants, exiles, as we call them, from Castro's Cuba. He has this great narrative of you know, rags, not riches, but, you know, he's a senator. And the interesting thing about him is that, you know, Hillary Clinton's strong, one of her strengths is that she appeals to Latino voters. And Rubio, of course, and has the ability to draw Latino voters, even though he's actually much less generous on the issue of illegal immigrants with pathways to citizenship than Clinton.
But couldn't they get that out of Jeb Bush, who after all has a Mexican wife and is fluent in Spanish?
Yeah, but I mean, I think Rubio, you know, Rubio is the real deal in that sense. And Rubio, you know, it depends. I wouldn't take my money off him, but I still think that Jeb Bush is waiting for his moment. But clearly he doesn't want to throw his name in until he feels he's got a real chance. It is an interesting field. You know, you've got this, you know, fringe guy, Bernie Sanders, who is running with the Democrats. He's not really a Democrat. He's a self-styled socialist.
He's the only non-Hillary Clinton Democratic candidate
right.
so far.
No. O'Malley has come in today.
Is O'Malley declared today?
That's okay. Right. The ex-Baltimore mayor.
Right. And you know, O'Malley's an interesting guy. And then you've got Jim Webb, the former U.S. senator, who's an interesting guy. And Lincoln Chafee, the former Rhode Island governor. And they're all actually, they all have distinguished records. But the question is whether they have the kind of that jelly that's required to galvanize a populace. And, you know, it's hard to imagine Hillary Clinton losing. But, you know, it's also... It's far off, and Hillary Clinton's a familiar name, and they love her, then they hate her, and then they're bored with her. And, you know, I think bored is actually one of the biggest issues. American attention span these days is very fickle, and, oh, my God, you know, more about Hillary Clinton, can I take more, is I think, actually a big issue.
Depends on whether they opt for experience. I mean, the idea of saying, elect me because I'm 39 years old doesn't necessarily wear it either. It would be nice to have someone there who... Well, no, I shan't be nasty about it.
Oh, come on. This is Monocle. We can say what we believe.
I really hate it when people come up and say, gosh, I don't know anything about Washington, elect me. And you get there and they can't find where the loo is.
But everybody does. Everybody runs on an outsider ticket. I can't remember the last time anybody ran for president saying, I'm a total company man. I'm the archetype of Washington insider.
No, but you can say I've been a very successful, relatively speaking, Secretary of State. I know my way around the world. Have you ever been out of the continent?
Well, on a not unrelated subject, finally, on the subject of sort of moving seamlessly around the world, today is not perhaps the most heralded of commemorative days, but it is International UN Peacekeepers Day, May 29th. 67 years, or 70-ish, thereabouts, since the first blue helmets were deployed, there has been very little slack in demand for their services. Just over 125,000 troops, police, military observers and civilian staff from 120 countries currently serve in 16 different operations, a profile of one of which, incidentally, you can read in the current edition of Monocle. Jeffrey, it is the archetypal impossible job. How well do they do, and are they getting better?
Well, you know, coming from Canada, it's really interesting to think about this, because part of the values of Canadians when I was young were the Canadian blue helmets. It was one of the honourable traditions of Canada. The Canadians who were in Cyprus, you know, for it seemed like centuries.
Which is where that Monocle piece is reporting from, indeed.
There you go. This was the noble calling, and Canada as a middle power like Norway and Finland embraced it. But I think if you look at the numbers, 25 years ago, those three countries had 3,000 troops in peacekeeping. Today, collectively, they have 500. You've seen this global shift. It's now the developing countries, Nigeria, and Pakistan and India, Bangladesh, that have these huge numbers of peacekeepers in the thousands, 8,000 from Pakistan, 9,000 from Bangladesh. Of course, the problem is that these are not well-trained or well-supervised troops. And so we're having a lot of problems with credibility, abuse of power, sexual abuse, exploitation. So the nature of peacekeeping and who they are has changed dramatically.
I mean, a couple of things there. I mean, yes, the United States is now down to 95 members of peacekeeping. Norway used to be a big one. In fact, that when you in the olden days, when you studied foreign policy and defense policy in Norway, they were very proud of the fact that they were a nation of peacekeepers. I used to ask whatever happened to all the Viking raiders that we used to hear about. They'd gone all peace. They have as well declined in numbers. One thing I think we have to remember about the developing countries, rather like the South in the U.S. or Northern Ireland in the U.K., these are poor parts of the world. And so a soldiering occupation was a way that you could pull up the bootstraps. If you are in Africa or Bangladesh, a regular salary as a soldier, which also has a certain cachet, must be extremely attractive.
It also means for the countries who own those armies that they don't have to pay their soldiers' wages while they're on UN deployment.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just a final thought, I guess, with the perhaps obvious exception of this point of FIFA, is there anywhere in the world right now that a UN peacekeeping force could be profitably dispatched, or something the UN should be thinking about?
Ooh, FIFA's an interesting one.
Well, the problem is where they ought to be. They aren't working very well. Think of the Palestinian-Israeli border. The problem with peacekeepers is they aren't often allowed to shoot anyone. And I'm not referring in that particular case to that particular border.
Indeed so. Jeffrey, are we likely to see any more deployed in the very imminent future, do you think?
Well, you know, I think it's a broken system, but it lurches along. It's again, you know, we talked about this earlier. These big institutions are hard to reform, and you know, there's been this evolution. But, you know, I don't think you're going to see the whole program canceled, but I think that, you know, it's mostly in Africa these days that you find UN peacekeepers. And, well, and when you think about geopolitics, you know, Latin America is pretty stable these days. The Western Hemisphere in general is pretty stable. You know, the biggest instabilities are, in fact, in Africa. You know, I think it's going to lurch along, but I think celebrating it, I think, you know, we know that, let's be generous and say they try.
Okay, well, on that note, a happy UN Peacekeepers Day to any UN peacekeepers who may be listening. That's all for today's Midori House. It was produced by Alice Block, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mariana Zuniga. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Daniel Giacopelli will be here with Monocle's International Playlist. Marcus Hippie is back at 1900 with The Menu. At 2200, The Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Peter Cardwell. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. But for this edition, goodbye. Have a great weekend.